Welcome to Home and Family Finance with Paul Barry. It's your family, it's your finances, and it's your future. Home and Family Finance is sponsored by the Defense Credit Union Council, serving those who serve our country, and by CUNA, the Credit Union National Association. Now, here's the host of Home and Family Finance, Paul Barry.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's always a pleasure to have you here with me on the program. I think of you as being here in the studio with me because we're talking about something that's so common to all of us, our finances. What you may not know, and I'm going to make sure that you do and throughout the rest of the month, this is Financial Literacy Month. Financial Literacy Month. Now, what is Home and Family Finance? This is a program that is dedicated to financial literacy. That's why we've done the show for the past 7 or 8 years, to help you understand things that would make your life easier in terms of making the right decisions about your home, your family, and your finances. And I'm not going to sit here and go too long talking about what we don't know. But let me give you my my definition, actually Wikipedia's definition of financial literacy. Financial literacy is the ability to understand how money works in the world, how someone manages to earn or make it, how the person manages it, how he or she invests it, that is to turn it into more, and how that person donates it to help others. That's what financial literacy means. I ask you every week, are you financially fit? And in order to be financially fit, you have to have some idea of being literate. You have to understand what it means to be literate. Are you? I'm not here to judge. I'm just here to help you figure out what's best for you in terms of what you need to know. And that's the purpose of our program. So all of this month is Financial Literacy Month. And I challenge you to do something that's going to make you more financially literate, make you more financially fit, that you can make the right decisions, whether you're single, you're a college grad, or whether you are the breadwinner of the family, or you're the lady of the house who has to make sure everybody does the right thing. Being financially fit means that you are ready to do what has to be done, means that you can make right decisions about the money as it comes in, no matter how much or how little. You have to know how to make the right decisions. I hope you look. I'm like you. I'm learning every day. I'm surprised at how little we really do know. We graduate every year. We graduate students out of high school, and they don't even know how to balance their checkbook. And one of the things that you as a parent can do is make sure that your school is teaching the right thing. I got to tell you, there's a report coming out, and it'll be on my show next week with Shannon and Skylar from PricewaterhouseCoopers. They did a study on this very issue. You're going to be surprised how many teachers are uncomfortable because they don't feel they're able to teach properly financial literacy. That's how important all of this is. Okay, well, this week we have some very interesting guests on the show. You know, as I was saying to my first guest, Jim Patterson, he's senior associate editor at Kiplinger Personal Finance, and I was saying to him, growing up in Detroit, we used to say, how goes the auto industry, so goes the U.S. economy. And at that time, folks, it was true because we didn't have Hondas and we didn't have BMWs. And all of, none of those cars were out there, and Mercedes, but they were just a small percentage of the auto market. So the biggest item that we bought, I believe, was the automobile. Jim's going to join us to talk about the state of the auto industry now. And then as part of our, again, Financial Literacy Month, we asked Rod Griffin. We've invited Rod Griffin to the show. He's Director of Public Relations for Experian, the National Consumer Education. And we'll talk about what you do or what you don't know as consumers. But first, let me welcome Jim Patterson. Jim, welcome to the show. Nice to have you with us.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely, man. The moment this came across my desk, I said, yeah, I got to talk to him because I still believe that much of what happens in this country, much of what we do in terms of our financial capabilities and our growth and everything else is still related to the automobile. Is that a fair statement?
I think that is a very fair statement, Paul. Cars are one of the biggest things that any family is going to spend their money on, and the auto industry is a very big employer still in this country. You were talking about how things have changed from decades ago. Now we have a lot more foreign brands in the market, but, you know, they employ a lot of people, too. We got a lot of foreign automakers who have got factories in, you know, many states across this country. And, of course, the big three are still going strong.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a key part of our economy, and it's a key part of everybody's finances.
Jim, you know, and as we point out again, is the importance of understanding the role that automobile and the industry plays in our economy. When I was growing up, the automotive industry we waited for the new cars to come out, and there were foreign cars, but they were less than 2 or 3% of the economy
a very small slice of the pie,
a very small slice, and now that's up in where 20 to 30%, isn't that somewhere in that area, isn't it?
Something like that. It kind of depends on how you define it. You know, is a foreign car, you know, say a Hyundai, if it's built in somewhere in the U.S., you know, it's a foreign brand and the profits go to the foreign automaker. But obviously they're employing U.S. workers and sourcing a lot of parts and whatnot from U.S. suppliers. So, you know, it kind of depends on how exactly you define, domestic brands versus foreign. But certainly, you know, the overseas competition is a very big part of the market.
A big enough part of the pie to make a difference and to have an impact.
Right, absolutely, sure.
Absolutely. Jim is the senior associate editor for Kiplinger. He joined Kiplinger back in December 2010, covering energy and commodities markets, autos, environment, and sports business. For the Kiplinger Letter. Prior to joining Kiplinger, he covered federal grant funding and congressional appropriations for the Thompson Publishing Group, writing for a range of print and online publications. He holds a bachelor's in history from the University of Rochester, and we are so delighted to have you on the show. So, what about this auto industry? I'm going to just, in a word, is the auto industry in good shape or bad shape? And when we come back from the break, we'll talk more about it.
Well, it's definitely in good shape, and I can certainly talk a lot about why that is the case.
Okay.
It's going to be another good year for the auto industry.
All right. That's Jim Patterson. You should know this because you're probably going to buy a car. You're thinking about it. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry, on the Radio America Network. We'll be right back with more.
Part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about, or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
And my guest is Jim Patterson, Senior Associate Editor of Kiplinger Personal Finance. Now, here's what caught my attention, Jim. Car makers are in, this is from your article, car makers are in for another strong year after a blistering 2015, but the market will start to cool off a bit. And here's the part that spells better deals for some buyers. What's happening here?
Right. Well, what's been going on is, you know, car sales have been rising really, really briskly pretty much every year since the Great Recession. You know, back in 2009, practically everybody stopped buying cars because, people were concerned about losing their jobs. A lot of people did lose their jobs. The stock market was plummeting. You know, nobody really wanted to take the risk of buying a new vehicle back then. So sales really cratered in 2009, but they've recovered strongly every year since. And in fact, last year, 2015, the U.S. auto industry set an all-time record for the most cars and light trucks sold, 17.5 million new vehicles.
Wow.
That's a very big number.
Right.
And we think that this year will be another really banner year for sales. People are still flocking to dealers. They're still driving off in new cars. But I think that probably we're going to come in a little bit less than that peak we hit last year. And I still think it's going to be a great year for auto sales. I think we're going to see a very big number. But I think that probably a lot of the folks who had put off buying a car in the wake of the Great Recession, they probably have done so now. So there's probably not as many likely buyers out there.
Right.
And what has also been going on in a number of cases, a lot of people have been leasing new cars in recent years. And that's very important because that means that when that lease is up, usually after 2 or 3 years, most of those people return that car and that car gets resold in the used car market. So there's a lot of really good used cars for sale right now. That'll probably compete a little bit with the new car market. You know, there's some
So a lot of competition to the new car market. So here's where the tire meets the road, so to speak, Jim. Is this the right time? Everybody's sitting there now waiting for your answer. Is this the best time to buy a new car or a used car?
Well, I think it's a great time to buy a vehicle if you're looking for something that is smaller and fuel efficient, because those are the vehicles, whether new or used, that are not in vogue right now. You know, gasoline prices are pretty low. They're about $2 a gallon for regular national average. So a lot of people are buying pickups. They're buying SUVs. That's very popular right now. So if you're somebody who prefers a smaller vehicle, somebody who cares about getting good gas mileage, you're going to have a lot of good deals to choose from. And I think it's a buyer's market for those folks, whether they're shopping for new or used.
Right.
Now, if you're looking for a truck, if you're looking for an SUV, you're probably not going to see the really juicy deals. Again, that's true for both the used car market and the new market, again, because this is what's popular. This is what's in demand right now. So, if you're looking for a pickup, if you're looking for a Jeep or something like that, you're going to probably be paying quite a bit and not getting a great discount necessarily or generous financing or anything like that. So really depends on who you are and what you're looking
for. What you're looking for. Okay. And the other question that my audience says to me, if I'm looking for a used car, or I don't think I get a new car, maybe a used car. Do I want to get a used car? Do I want to go to a dealership to do that? Or do I want to go to one of these many different new companies that are selling used cars? Where am I going to get my best deal? Is that I don't know if that's a fair question or if there's an easy answer, but that's the question that I get.
I don't know if there's an easy answer to that question. I think that now more than ever, you're probably going to see good deals at the dealership, again, because of that trend of more leasing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of 2 and 3 year old used cars that are being returned at the end of leases. You know, these are cars that are sold in 2013, 2014.
Mm-hmm.
They're low mileage, and the dealers, a lot of them are being sold as through certified pre-owned programs.
Right.
And that comes with a lot of inspections.
Pretty good deals.
A lot of a lot of assurances to you, the buyer, that the car is in good shape. There's usually some sort of warranty.
Hold on there a minute, Jim. Let me stop for just a minute. Jim Batterson, my guest. This is Home and Family Finance. We'll be right back. Listening to Home and Family Finance on Radio America. I'm your host, Paul Berry, and we thank you so much for joining us. Our program sponsors, the Defense Credit Union Council and the Credit Union National Association. We thank them for their continued support of this program dedicated to making all of us financially fit. And you can reach out to us if you want to at any time by reaching us at hffradio.com, www.hffradio.com. We appreciate that if you do. The Defense Credit Union Council and its member credit unions believe that financial readiness equals mission readiness and supports the efforts of Military Saves in their dedication to improving the financial well-being of our troops. Military Saves, it's a year-round campaign, folks, that seeks to motivate, support, and encourage military families to save money, to reduce debt, and to build wealth. As part of the Department of Defense's financial readiness campaign, Military Saves acts as a resource center for information on financial education and counseling. Check out its links to useful websites for military families where they can learn better money management and can find partners who can help military members achieve their financial goals. Military Saves. Set a goal, make a plan, save automatically. And you can go to militarysaves.org for more information and take the Savers Pledge today. And, of course, whether you are in the military or not, all of us should be saving 5%. That means if you make $10, you're going to save a portion of that, 5% of that money, okay? Every week, every payday, and make sure that you do it. And if you've saved up enough money to buy a used car or a new car, and many of us have, as you just heard Jim tell us, over 17.5 million units moved last year, and it's going to be close to that this year. So what should I be looking for, Jim? I want the car. Jim Patterson, Senior Associate Editor, Kiplinger Personal Finance. talking about the state of the auto industry. What should I be shopping for on the car? I mean, all these cars are all pretty dynamic, but is it safety? Is it new tech? What should I be dealing with? What should be at the front of my list?
Well, for a lot of buyers, it's going to be safety, and that really is an issue of technology more and more. There's a lot of pressure on the auto industry to roll out new safety systems that rely on things like rear-view cameras. There's a lot of systems going into new cars now that will do some of the driving for you effectively, systems that will hit the brakes if you don't do it in time and the car can sense that you're coming up to a traffic jam in front of you or something like that, or systems mm-hmm. to keep you from wandering out of your lane. So there's a lot of really new and exciting safety-related technology going to a lot of new cars, and not just luxury vehicles by any means. This is becoming pretty standard stuff on mainstream models. So if you're shopping for a new car for the first time, maybe in a few years, I think you're going to see a lot of this sort of stuff that just didn't exist the last time you were at a dealership.
And I know that the Europeans, and not only Europeans, foreign, let me call them foreign car makers, are really putting a lot of this safety technology into their cars. Are the U.S. automakers following suit, or are they leading the pack here?
Oh, they're definitely at least keeping up with the foreign competition. I mean, I can't really say that there's a clear-cut leader or winner when it comes to this sort of safety technology. I mean, you tend to see it first on luxury vehicles because those are expensive models, and it's easier for an automaker to incorporate the cost of new technology into those pricey models. Early on, we saw a lot of this sort of safety crash avoidance sort of technology on brands like Mercedes. Volvo comes to mind. Of course, Volvo has always prided itself on safety, but it's proliferating everywhere, and the American automakers are, I think, as good at it as anybody else. And so there's no, to me, there's no, no clear distinction between, domestic versus foreign here.
Okay. And regarding who's going to win the battle over me buying a car, am I more likely to buy a foreign car, foreign-made car, or a domestic-made car?
Well, that depends a lot on what you're looking for. If you need a truck and like a real heavy-duty truck to do real work, you're probably going to buy a Ford, a GM, mm-hmm. or a Chrysler, because those companies really, they know trucks and they sell the most trucks. And, not to cast aspersions on any other brands,
sure.
I think it's widely viewed that, the big three are the dominant players when it comes to making trucks. And that's true for larger SUVs as well. If you're on the other end of the spectrum, you're looking for a compact, you're looking for a hybrid, you're looking for something fuel efficient, the big three offer all of those as well. But that's probably where you're going to be more likely to also look at the Japanese brands, especially, those economy, more frugal cars.
Yeah.
That's been their bread and butter.
Okay. Jim Patterson, what a pleasure. And folks, as Jim will tell you, as I will, there's a lot of information out there on the net for you to find out, internet, Google, whatever. Don't buy a car in the dark. Make sure you know all you need to know. Jim, thanks for being with us. Come back and see us again soon, would you?
I absolutely will. My pleasure.
Okay. Great April to you, and I appreciate you being with us. Coming up next, more on financial literacy from a person that knows a lot about your habits. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry.
Safe, smart, and secure with your finances. Welcome back to Home and Family Finance with your host, Paul Berry.
And as you'll recall, if you listened to us at the beginning of the program, we told you a couple of things. The first thing that we shared with you is that April is Financial Literacy Month. Financial Literacy Month. What does that mean? We talk about on this program of being financially fit, being able to make the right decisions about your home, your family, and your finances. That means that there's a certain amount of an education level that is needed to do those things. And unfortunately, many of us just simply weren't ever given the right education. Let me just again read what financial literacy means to you, or should mean. It is the ability to understand how money works in the world, how someone manages to earn or make it, how that person manages it, money, how he or she invests money, and how that person donates money to help others. Does that sound like you? Does that sound like the person you are? And if not, then listen very carefully to my next guest. Rod Griffin is director of public education for Experian. He is responsible for Experian's National Consumer Education Program and supports the company's community involvement and corporate responsibility efforts. And he speaks regularly at regional and national financial literacy events and supports various national consumer education initiatives, including the Life Smarts Consumer Knowledge Competition, for which he serves on the Corporate Advisory Board. So he knows a thing or two about financial lit. And first of all, let me welcome you, Rod, to the program. Nice to have you on the show.
Well, Paul, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
And in your experience, are those the kind of people that you're finding? I've read what financial literacy is. Are you finding people represent that example?
What I find is people want to be that example, but often are struggling to get the information they need to be that example. And I think that's why we do what we do. We want to help people be able to manage their finances well and be successful. So yeah. I think there's a lot of desire to get there, but a lot of not understanding how to get there in some cases.
We just don't have the basic knowledge as yet, or at least some of us do. I don't paint everybody with the same brush. Obviously, there are many people that are financially literate, that are financially fit, that listen to the show, that know what they're doing. But the problem that I have is so many people don't know. They simply don't have any idea. They weren't trained. They go to school. They come out. Rod, they don't even know how to balance their checkbooks. And no one knows that any better than folks with Experian. Explain what Experian does.
Sure. Experian is the company line is we're the world's largest information services provider. So we do information globally. But in the U.S., we're best known as one of the three national credit reporting companies. So we collect information about how people manage their credit accounts from lenders and other sources. And then when you apply for credit, we share that credit report to the lender, and they use it to help them decide whether or not you qualify. So the credit reports that we collect and maintain are probably one of the most important financial documents that anybody has.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, people don't look at them. You can get a free copy once every 12 months. But we find that less than half of people who are eligible to get that free report actually do.
It's amazing. Less than half actually do. And let me suggest to you, and through no fault of Experian, half of those of the half that do don't know how to read it, can't read what they get in front of them. I mean, we've done some studies here. We've got people. I've got my credit report, but I'm not sure I understand just exactly what it says here. I've been looking for my credit score, and I don't see it. Rod, they don't know what they're looking at.
Yeah, and when you get it from Experian, I will tell you this. When you get it directly from Experian, and you can get it free, again, at www.annualcreditreport.com.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go there, you'll find a mailing address. You can also write or call. There's a telephone number, and unfortunately, I haven't committed them to memory. But go to that website. And when you get your report from Experian, we put it in a form that's very easy to read, very easy to understand.
You do.
And so it's not like looking at the copy the lender gets. When the lender gets it, they get the same information, but it's formatted in a way that is really designed for computer analysis and that sort of thing. So it can be really confusing to look at. So if you get your personal report, it's plain English, like reading a book. Each entry says this is your account, the name, who owns it, how much your balance is. Much easier to read and understand.
I don't mean to paint. You're right. We've often had folks who have complained that we've sent them to your plain speak examples because it does make a difference. And by the way, let me also say this. We're talking with Rod Griffin, director of public education for Experian. For those of you who think that the Experian folks sit in some dark place waiting to get you. That is not their role. That is not what they're about. I mean, that's not what you do. You have to make reports based on accurate information. But it's not about waiting to make sure that you screw somebody over when it comes to their credit report, is it?
No, absolutely not. Actually, really just the opposite. The credit report is a tool that helps lenders make loans to actually more people than they otherwise would be able to because it helps them assess risk effectively. And it really should be a tool everybody uses.
Mm-hmm.
There shouldn't be any surprises that when you go in to apply for a loan, you can get your credit report in advance. You can see credit scores. You should be able to walk in and know exactly what to expect. and use that as a financial tool. And lenders want to loan money. That's how they make money. And they want you to be a customer, and you want to get the credit that you need, and we want to facilitate that. It really works for everybody that it's actually the reverse. We want to help people get the credit they need because it's good for everyone involved.
Hey, folks, this is very simple, and I want you to listen because you're talking directly to someone who works at one of those reporting stations, who's telling you how they operate and how they do what they do. And he's also, when he comes back, going to tell you the importance of being financially literate, why it is important that you understand your credit rating and how the system works. We'll be right back. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm Paul Berry.
We want you to be part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about. Or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
My guest is Rod Griffin. He is Director of Public Education for Experian. He is responsible for consumer educator related programs here. And he joins us now because we're talking about the basis of this is Financial Literacy Month, April. It is a time for you to better educate yourself, to have a better understanding of how the system works that you use every day to spend, to make and spend your money. Rod, from your perspective, what is the most important things that people need to know here? And the importance of financial literacy from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, working in the credit reporting industry, you know, I would say that one of the most important things they need to understand is what a credit report is and how it works for them to help them be financially successful, and to understand what credit scores are and how they work, and to use them as a financial tool. And you know, that's something that most people struggle with, at least in understanding what credit reports are and how to engage in that system.
Okay, and what they are really is just a representation of my behavior when it comes to my credit. Is that fair?
That's true, yeah. It's your credit report is simply a record of your credit transactions, your financial relationships, and how you're managing them. And everything there in a credit report will be debt-related, so credit card accounts, mortgage loans, auto loans, and how you're paying them, whether you're paying them on time or if you're late, or if you have public records like bankruptcy or a civil judgment, you owe a debt through the court, or you haven't paid your taxes, you can see a tax lien. And that's pretty much all there is in a credit report. And your lender's are going to look at that to see if you've paid your other lenders well, and if you have, you'll probably pay them well too. And that's really the fundamental way the system works.
And how can I help myself when it comes to my credit report? What do I need to do to stay on top of where I am? Do I need to check it? Do I need to kind of ignore it? Do I need to call you? Do I need to write to you? What do I need to do to make sure that I'm doing, I'm talking about the consumer, everything that I can do to make sure I've got the best possible record?
Sure. Don't ignore it. That would be like the worst possible thing you could do. Get a copy. We're just talking about the fact you can get a copy of your report from Experian and the other two national credit reporting companies free once every 12 months. And you can do that online at www.annualcreditreport.com. I don't think I can say that enough. And you'll see exactly what's in that report. You'll be able to identify any issues you might have. There are some fundamental things that you always have to do to have good credit. One, you have to pay your bills on time every single time. Your credit history, your payment history, mm-hmm. is the most important element in credit scores, and so that's going to have the first effect on a credit score in the report. The other thing you have to do is keep your balances low on your credit cards. If you pay your bills down, keep them as low as you possibly can. The lower, the better. The better your credit scores will be, and the better you will better luck you'll have in getting credit when you need it, or not luck at all. You'll be able to qualify for the credit you need. What people ask all the time is, do I have to carry a balance on a credit card? And the answer is no, you don't. Ideally, if you use your credit card, you would pay the balance in full each month. That would be the best thing you could do. What we find is that people with the very best credit scores have what we call utilization rates, or their balances as compared to their limits, of less than 10%. So if you have a credit card with a $1,000 limit, the people with the best scores would carry a balance of no more than about $100.
Okay, and from your perspective and experience, How are we as Americans doing across the board? Are we well over that number? I know that the amount of credit that we owe is pretty, it's pretty substantial.
It is significant, and the average credit score in the U.S. is the Vantage score. We just did a survey not too long ago, is 669, which is not prime. You talk about credit scores. To have what we think of as prime credit scores, very good credit scores, are going to be above 700, usually 720, 730.
Okay.
So, average scores are okay, not great.
How difficult is it to move that number up or down? I guess down, if I don't pay, it goes pretty quickly. But how about improving my credit score? If it's 669, I want it to be 700. Can I get there in a year? Can I get there in less time?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
I tell people, the answer to every single credit reporting question is it depends.
Okay.
And if you have a 669, we have 220 million people with credit reports, and they're all unique. And so, someone who has, who's a young person, a millennial in their mid-20s, may have a different set of circumstances than someone like me who's used credit for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So what you need to do and how long it would take would just depend on your situation. But yes, if you do the right things, you could see your credit scores improve relatively quickly.
Rod, from the perspective of Experian right now, when we look at the fact that understanding from a financial literacy point of view, we have college kids coming out, as you know, with tremendous debt. And I mean, when you're not making any money, 20 grand is tremendous debt. So what's happening here from your perspective? How do you all look at this and how do you read this? I mean, these kids are starting out with some pretty pretty ugly credit, aren't they?
Well, not necessarily. And I kind of throw myself in the same boat 25, almost 30 years ago when I went to college. I graduated and I had $25,000 in student loan debt myself. So that's about the average debt today.
Right.
So, yes, that's a lot of money. But the majority, and the studies show that the majority are doing okay in managing those debts. But I think it goes to the overall, again, financial literacy that we're talking about. We just did a recent survey, and we found that millennials, the majority, about 71%, consider themselves knowledgeable about credit, but more than half don't know what their credit card's interest rate is. They don't know what their spending limits are, so they haven't spent, they haven't done any budgeting.
Okay.
They don't know how much they can spend. And almost 30% have maxed out their credit card. So you couple that with student loan debt, and it's a recipe for at least serious problems.
Yeah, that's a heck of a place to start from if we consider graduation exactly that, a starting point for these young people. When I come back, I want to talk about how they should handle this because I think looking for jobs and dealing with and I'll give a perfect example of exactly what I'm talking about. My guest is Rod Griffin. We're thankful for him for coming here to talk with you. He's the director of public education for Experian. Getting through this period for young folks can be difficult. We'll talk about that a little bit and some other things. This is Home and Family Finance on this April, Financial Literacy Month it is. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Listening to Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry. My guest, Rod Griffin, Director of Public Education for Experian. We're talking about, of all things, this month of April, Financial Literacy Month. And Rod, if I may, what, from your perspective, does Financial Literacy Month mean?
Financial Literacy Month just is an entire month devoted to really helping people understand the importance of being in control of their personal finances and learning how to take control of their personal finances. So gaining knowledge and listening to shows like this can help them be more successful, and that's what we're in business to do. I think you and I are both committed to helping people become more successful.
Absolutely, and it's good to feature. I know one of your organizations that you represent started this some 20 years ago, you said, right?
Right, the Jumpstart Coalition for Financial Literacy was founded in the late 1990s, and Experian was actually a founding member of the Jumpstart Coalition. It's still very active today, and they initiated the concept, and then in 2004, the Senate passed a resolution making it official. So April has since then been National Financial Literacy Month.
Well, I think it's a great idea, obviously, based on what we do, and I know that you're busy doing the consumer education aspect of it too. But let me get back for a moment to the millennials. I want to give you an example and have you tell us how this young man, and I'm going to talk about one of my children, graduated from college. We had three. He's graduated and he has a student debt of maybe $3,000 or $4,000. I don't know what the number is, but here's the problem. He had a job coming out of college, all set up, but the job fell through because he couldn't get a visa to his job in London. So he's been looking for a job since that time. He received a collection letter from the school that says we want to get our money back from you because you owe it to us. And he doesn't have a job. And now he does have dad, but he doesn't want to rely on dad and my money. So he what does he do? What does he do here? Rod, he's just one. I'm using him as an example. A lot of kids have they don't have jobs. They would pay if they could. What do they do?
Yeah, it's a difficult situation with student loans. They do have some advantages. I guess you could think of them as advantages, but alternatives that he may be able and others may be able to take advantage of. The first thing to do is talk to your lender. Okay. Ask them if there are alternatives. Can it be deferred? Could it be, could there be a hardship deferment? Could you consolidate the loans and perhaps at a longer term with a lower interest rate that would help you maintain those payments over time? So talk to the lender, see what the alternatives are, because with student loans, especially with student loans, there are often alternatives that aren't available for other types of loans that might help you get through that rough time. So always talk to the lender first.
And I think that's what you just said, and I knew you were going there. Talk to the lender. Talk to folks. Don't ignore. Don't put that letter on the desk and stick it under something and hope it's going to go away. It doesn't go away, does it?
It does not go away. And if you're late on those payments, it's going to be part of your credit report for at least 7 years. So it's going to be there quite a long time.
So if you are late, folks, on your payment, even now, 22, 23, 24 years old, just out, and you can't pay it, and you don't pay it, it's going to stay there until you're at least 30. That's a scary part, but that's the way it works, doesn't it?
It is. And, you know, it's a record of how you've managed your debts. And if and that's fundamentally, if you're unable to pay one lender, you're probably going to struggle to pay others as well. And that's why they'll look at a credit report. And, you know, if you're paying your existing lenders well, you'll probably pay them well. Just sort of the human nature at a very basic level. But talking to the lenders doesn't hurt your credit report, and it might help in the long run.
Absolutely. Yeah. Give us the big picture, Rod. We're talking with Rod Griffin, Director of Public Relations for Experian. He's one of three of the credit reporting agencies operating in this company. From your perspective and from that of Experian, are we getting things going to get better? Are we going to get worse? Credit's going to get better? Credit's going to get worse? Where do you see this going?
I'm very optimistic that people are becoming more knowledgeable, and we have the opportunity, and I have the opportunity to talk to more and more people all of the time. And there's a huge desire to engage with my company and the people that work here, and to understand what we do and how they can, how as a consumer you can drive that. And so I think we'll get better as the economy through recently. We saw a downturn. We've seen that start to come back. Delinquency rates decline. People actually started saving more.
Thank you, Rod. Rod Griffin, Director of Public Education for Experian, my guest. Come back and see us again soon, and we'll be back next week, same time, same place. Put some of this into action. Think about Financial Literacy Month. What can you learn? How can I learn it? What should I do? That's what it's all about. Thanks, everybody, for being with us. We'll see you next week.